So good evening, everybody, and thank you for coming out on this first of snowy night in Boston. Hopefully you didn't slip and slide your way here, and we are thankful that you came out and you have been rewarded with cheese and various other snacks. So thank you for joining us this evening. I'm here to introduce Julie Cohen, who we are excited to have talk about her new book, Configuring the Network Itself, which was very recently released. Julie is a professor of law at the Georgetown Law School, and she had actually worked on this book while she was a visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School here, as well as a Berkman Center fellow. So there's lots of Berkman Center connections within this book, and so we're really excited to have her come talk about it. I will turn it over to her in a minute, but just before that, a couple of quick notes about this evening. One, as with all Berkman Talks, if you've not been to them before, they are recorded, and we will put them up on our website afterwards. So I will run around with a mic when you have questions, and those will be recorded for posterity. If you choose not to be recorded, we don't have to record you on the microphone. Just let us know. And there are books available right in the corner being sold via the Harvard Law School bookstore. The book is also available online under a Creative Commons license at Julie Cohen's website, which is linked to from the Berkman Center announcement. I'll let you take it from here, Julie. Welcome.
Microphone on. Okay, thank you so much. It's really nice to be back here to talk about it now that it's finished. It's nice of all of you to come out when the weather's so dismal, and I have to apologize because I'm going to cough at you a little bit, but I'll try to keep it to a minimum. So my interest in the topic of the network itself began with a puzzle, which is kind of on two dimensions. So here's one of them. Within the world of legal theory, we think we've pretty much figured out how to talk about the relationship between information rights and human freedom. And this is kind of how it goes. Pursuing important... I don't yet have a slide up.
Sorry.
Thank you. Pursuing important goods like cultural progress and critical independence and technical innovation requires, we think, a philosophy of enlightened libertarianism that plays off of the relationship between freedom of speech and freedom of choice in markets. And so for copyright, for example, that story suggests that the problem to be overcome policy-wise is an incentive gap. Creativity requires incentives. Copyright provides them. As long as we provide safeguards for things like parody and criticism, the market exchange of culture will also advance freedom of speech and democratic discourse. And in the case of privacy, the problem to be overcome is an information gap. And if they're armed with correct information, then people can make autonomous choices about what information to share, and recipients of that information can then use it to connect people to goods and services that they want. We can provide some narrowly drawn safeguards for particularly sensitive uses of information, but in general, that story says we benefit from openness, which enables freedom of speech and innovation and thriving information markets, so we should regulate all of that with a very light hand. I think something is missing in the way that legal academics and policymakers typically reason about technology policy problems. The ordinary ways that we talk about cultural progress and privacy and facilitating information markets generally fail pretty miserably to describe the user experience of the networked world, which increasingly is not the experience of freedom. Instead, people are losing control of their information environment. They're losing control of information flows to and from and about them. We're losing, at least in the formal legal sense, essential aspects of our ability to interact with mass culture. We aren't actually getting to make autonomous choices about our privacy. And we're losing the ability to understand the way the technical aspects of the online environment work. So that's the first puzzle, right? All of that. We think it's a story about human freedom, freedom of choice, freedom of speech, but actually on a practical level, freedom seems to be seeping away. And then here's the second puzzle, which is that these stories that we tell about information and human freedom have a political consequence. The emphasis on freedom through unfettered openness and regulatory restraint prevents advocates for free culture and advocates for privacy from making common cause and from forging a populist politics of information rights that really might actually promote individual freedom. I think these problems, as I thought about them, I began to see these puzzles as deeply ideological in origin. Our abstract language about freedom and autonomy and speech and markets doesn't tell us much of anything about how we interact with technology or about how technology affects us, and that's because that language is based on bad assumptions about the way the world works. We've allowed a particular ideology imported from liberal political theory to frame our understanding of the world, our assumptions about people and what makes them tick, and then to infect our approach to both design and public policy. So here's a well-known diagram that I love, taken from a work that I assume is well familiar to all of you, a pioneering and very important work that also illustrates this ideological capture. This is, of course, Lessig's diagram of the four regulatory modalities. But look first at the center. We're committed in our ideological DNA to the notion of the autonomous, disembodied, rational self who makes private, pre-political choices and who is a dot, right? Has no gender, has no culture, it's just there. And those choices, in turn, can be affected by application of various external regulatory vectors. So put differently, liberal theory treats self and culture as fundamentally separate entities, but that view of reality is, of course, just wrong. We're culturally constructed all the way down, and law and legal institutions aren't separate from those processes of cultural construction. They're embedded in it. So culture isn't a formless goo or a neutral backdrop out of which regulatory vectors emerge in solitary splendor where they can be technocratically deployed by disinterested regulators. It's not that way. Culture includes a wide variety of institutions and discourses that are political and social and economic that shape our experiences and our choices, that shape the dot, that construct the network self. And laws governing the uses of creative works and laws providing or withholding privacy protection operate right at that interface between self and culture. So an information policy that's informed solely by the empirical assumptions of liberal theory is really poorly equipped to investigate its own project because it begins by defining away the problem that it needs to solve. And a design ethic that's informed solely by these assumptions from liberal theory will stumble over and over again as its practitioners seek to enhance human freedom. Now, just to be really clear, I don't want to be understood as saying that I think the aspirations that we invoke in our discussions of information policy are bad ones. Autonomy, freedom of speech, freedom of choice, democracy, these are good things, right? They're important things. But the failure lies in our descriptive assumptions. We need to ask about the properties of the field and the properties of the dot, and that requires insights from disciplines that law often doesn't pay attention to because they seem messy and alien, right? Cultural studies, science, technology, and society, surveillance studies, they have strange terminology, weird jargon, no numbers, everything's a moving target. But some work is required there, and it can seem to be rather a drag, but simple analytical framing is a virtue only if you're talking about something simple. So I think we need to learn a new language to do information law and policy the right way, and that's what the book seeks to do. It reaches beyond the standard toolkit of liberal legal theory to open a more sustained dialogue with a broad range of scholarship in some of these other fields. And then it sets itself three tasks. And here they are. To first offer a descriptively defensible model of the self whose freedom we're trying to enhance. Second, ask how the structure of the networked information environment affects that self, and then and only then ask what kind of legal and policy interventions we should contemplate. So who's the dot? So in place of the liberal self, the book substitutes the situated user whose experience of the world is mediated by cultural goods and artifacts in ways that can't be assumed away. More detail and with more precision, cultural goods and technological artifacts configure their users. And they do this by altering our perceptual and physical relationships to the world around us. So what do I mean by that? That's a mouthful. Consider first a mundane example, a door opening device. So when door opening devices were developed, they altered our physical relationship to the world. You could close off physical spaces. You could regulate access into and out of them. You could heat them and cool them much more effectively. Over time, door opening devices alter our physical, our perceptual relationship to the world. They begin to seem natural and just the way things are. Try to imagine a world without door opening devices, and it's very hard to do. And this process of naturalization, of seeing the artifact as natural and inevitable and just the way things are, then begins to extend to the particular details of the implementation or the range of affordances that the particular design of the artifact permits. And in the case of door opening devices, it's an example that's well known from disability rights policy, right? Doors with doorknobs seem normal and natural and unremarkable to able-bodied people who are old enough to reach them and open them, and it's useful that they're inaccessible to small children, but they create barriers to accessibility for disabled adults, and so you could see disability rights advocacy around door-opening devices as an effort to make affordances and the way they mediate our perceptual and physical relationship to the world visible so they could be re-engineered. Now, this dynamic is, I think, even more pronounced in the case of networked information technologies and artifacts because those technologies also do explicit representational work. So consider now the process of navigating through a physical landscape. It used to be that you had to use a map to do that. And when you use a map, you are forced to consider not just point A and point B, but the entire geography in between so you can figure out how to go. When direction calculators like MapQuest and Google Maps came along, that changed. You got a complete sequence of directions, sometimes with a few choices to make here and there about highways, yes or no, and through cities or around them. And then when the navigator of choice becomes a GPS device, the process changes again. And you get your directions kind of spoon-fed to you one step at a time. You can go absolutely anywhere without ever really knowing where you are, right? You don't have to see anything outside of the path that you are traveling. Through this process, our need to be aware of anything other than point A and point B and the need to follow the directions one step at a time gets abstracted away. And that's a fairly profound change in our perception of the physical world around us. And in time, that comes to seem normal and natural too. Try asking my husband to go anywhere without a GPS. I guarantee it's impossible. I resist. Right? I don't want to be mediated that way, but there's only so much that one can do. Now, situated users aren't passive products of technological shaping. We exercise agency with respect to technology, but the agency that we exercise is different than the beloved legal abstractions like freedom of choice and freedom of speech tend to suggest. Situated users incorporate networked information technologies into everyday practice, into the ordinary rhythms and routines of everyday life in ways that are messy, that are heterogeneous, that are tactical, that can't be reduced to some overarching framework like freedom of choice. And most centrally, the everyday practice of situated users is playful in two different and equally important ways. They, that is we, appropriate and repurpose resources that we find around us in our landscapes, including, yes, commercial proprietary culture, including material artifacts, proprietary technologies, and we do this in ways that are not entirely predictable and that can be enormously creative. So that's the first sense of play, tactical play. The everyday practice of situated users is also heavily influenced by serendipity, by what we stumble across, the fortuitous, unpredictable encounters and juxtapositions that we can then grab and exploit. Okay, so this is the situated user. Now let's explore how situated users think and behave, with particular attention to these realms of information policy that I'm taking as my focus here, creativity in the production of culture, the domain of copyright, creativity in the production of technical innovation, and creativity in the realm of the subject, right? Privacy, critical subjectivity that can inform both self-government and innovation. Copyright, I think, is the easiest one of these. Copyright takes as its asserted goal the promotion of cultural progress. And then we have a story about how we get there, and it involves economic incentives to authors, but copyright law and theory have long treated creativity itself as a black box. And I think attention to the situated user and the play of everyday practice allows us to tell a more accurate and useful story about what creativity is and where it comes from. Creativity is creative practice. Everyone is a user of cultural goods first, an author only second, if at all. And users begin within their cultural landscapes. We begin with what we find around us. And I do call them landscapes rather than contexts or networks because they are material. They're made of spaces and bodies and objects and tangible goods. Creative practice is a process of working through these cultural landscapes, of appropriating and manipulating and remixing resources found within the cultural landscape way before the internet came along. Right? I teach my copyright class with great master works from art history that are hundreds of years old, and you can see the remix happening. And this process is playful in the two senses I just described, and it's where creativity comes from. Creativity feeds on appropriation and on serendipity. And again, you can go to any great art museum and see that much of what we now recognize and valorize as great art is precisely the product of a combination of those two things. Now, this suggests that we need to fundamentally rethink our understanding of how copyright promotes its goal of progress. Copyright's primary function is economic. It isn't about providing incentives for authors because creativity, authorship is motivated by other factors. Copyright does something else that's very important. It provides stability in the economic organization of cultural production. And to be clear, I think this promotes progress. Mass culture performs useful functions within our culture. It gives us things to share and to talk about and to appropriate. But copyright only promotes progress if users also have the freedom to engage with goods found in their cultural landscapes in the hands-on, iterative, appropriative ways that creative practice requires. So a copyright regime that wishes to promote progress has to balance economic stability with cultural mobility. Otherwise, I love this slide, it's so cheesy, right? We risk stifling progress instead of promoting it. We put all our eggs in one basket and we kill the golden goose that lays them, if I can mix metaphors atrociously. Now, the story about situated users and privacy is very similar. So the conventional understanding of privacy that we get from liberal theory is that it protects autonomous subjects who make choices that fulfill pre-existing preferences. And these are, of course, pre-cultural, pre-political subjects. And through this process of choice-making, we develop the critical capacity to be liberal citizens, and we can build associations and relationships, you know, as though we didn't start out already embedded in a matrix of relationships, which for anybody who has ever been a child, which is everybody in the room, right, is just ridiculous. And that's not right. Subjectivity is socially shaped all the way down. So where does critical capacity come from? It comes through the play of everyday practice. We develop our subjectivity and gradually our wherewithal for critical capacity. We can't escape social shaping, but we can gain, through the play of our everyday practice, a partial distance from it and a partial critical perspective on it. But of course, play requires breathing room. Room to experiment with beliefs, with identities, with affiliations. And privacy is, I think, best characterized as it's a term that is shorthand for these processes of boundary management that each of us makes use of, which constitute an ongoing negotiation between self and society, playing with the identities and the affiliations and the behaviors as we, over time, emerge as choosing subjects and change the choices that we make. Now this means, here's the silly seesaw again, that the balance that privacy seeks to achieve isn't about protecting the solitary subject from the buffeting effects of social and technological change. And that's a framing that just makes privacy seem so reactive and static, right? But that narrative has the function of privacy exactly backwards. Emergent subjectivity is dynamic, and privacy shelters subjectivity in motion. It gives us a buffer against external efforts to render our conduct more transparent, more amenable to external analysis and prediction, and more exposed. And if we tilt that balance too far in favor of transparency and exposure, we risk stifling our ability to change and grow and to develop critical perspective, partial critical perspective on the world around us. Just briefly, what about the code that regulates our behavior? I think it's the same thing again. A lot of trees have been killed debating whether and how code constrains liberty, but when we take situated users seriously, that just seems kind of silly. All architectures constrain liberty in one way or another, and the relevant question is how the rules that govern access to technical innovation further or frustrate technological innovation and technological diffusion. And again, we need to consider how innovation and diffusion happen, situated subjects playing with artifacts found within their technical landscapes, and tinkering with what results is where innovation and diffusion come from. And this suggests that regimes of trade secrecy and anti-circumvention and national security and the like have a balancing act of their own to perform to ensure that that we don't crowd out the place where innovation comes from. Okay. We've made it to the second question, but we won't spend as long on it. So how does the evolution of the networked information environment affect the play of everyday practice by situated users? What are we seeing around us? We hear a very great deal, particularly if we're at the Berkman Center, which I like to be at, about the enormous benefits of openness and of interoperability and of being networked. And those benefits are real. We all have access today to so much more information than we did when I was a student here back in the late 80s and early 90s, and it's at the click of a button. But there are some counterweights that I'd like to draw your attention to, and I want to focus on two of them. So we've moved from the dot to the field, and the first of these is what I call regimes of authorization. What are those? Well, networked information technologies as deployed by state actors and by commercial actors radically increase the degree to which our movements and transactions and communications are monitored and cross-referenced and authenticated. And legal scholars have not been blind to this, right? They've christened them architectures of control, and they've approached the emergence of architectures of control principally by focusing on what they prohibit and on how they constrain the liberty of the liberal self. I want to suggest to you that their significance consists instead in the ways that they change what is permitted and how they permit actions to take place. We're seeing, I think, the emergence of new political economies, new regimes organized around precise and pervasive and highly granular authorization of access to networks and places and resources and documents and data. This is how copyright protection technologies are supposed to work when they work. This is how it works every time you use an ATM or an Easy Pass or a Charlie card. This is how lots of things now work, and this is how many more things will work if people get their dreams who are designing these artifacts. And of course, making regimes like this work requires new discourses about why precise and seamless and highly granular authorization is important and necessary. Some of those discourses have to do with convenience, and I want to talk about that in a second, but others are discourses of authority. We hear a lot about trade secrecy and about state secrets and about the need to know, the need to keep the circulation of certain types of information within authorized circles. Of course, if we remember that the focus of our concern ought to be the situated subject, whose perceptions and even whose very subjectivity is configured by her devices and artifacts, we ought to be considering some other things as well. What is the end result of all this? What is the output of this process? The emerging regimes of authorization seek to create a more standardized, predictable, and authorized information environment. And that works to the extent you make people more standardized and compliant and tractable, to the extent you instill habits of behavior and thought that will suggest to them that they benefit from obeying. And this affects, I think, the play of everyday practice, both because it imposes external constraints on folks and because it trains us to play differently, trains us to be more compliant. Okay, here's the second one. Is the extent to which best practices in the design of networked artifacts and interfaces increasingly operate to obscure their workings from users. Now, it's tempting to talk about the design of the networked information society and the geography of networked information, of information networks as consisting of flows of information that are widely accessible at least in theory to most everyone. And it's tempting to talk about code in terms of its transparency and, in Jonathan Zittrain's wonderful term, its generativity. And that's right, but from the perspective of the ordinary network user, there's something else going on as well. We prize seamless, intuitive design, the sort of design that the iPad and the Google interface have in common, what Mark Weiser called in a slightly different context, unremarkable computing, computing that kind of fades into the background. And we prize seamless, convenient personalization. This comes initially from Tim Berners-Lee's dream of the semantic web. We want the network to read our minds and do for us the things that we want so we don't have to tell it what we want all the time. And so I call these technologies autonomic, because when they work right, they work the way the autonomic nervous system is supposed to work. Those are the nerves that regulate your breathing and the beating of your heart, your circulation, your digestion. If you're noticing this stuff, it ain't good, right? You want it to just happen in the background. These technologies are designed to make the interface disappear. But that process makes the operational logics of the networked information environment opaque to the situated selves who inhabit it. And that design ethic, too, is reinforced by some discourses of authority. And they're similar. They operate to professionalize innovation, to channel information to those who need to know it. And again, the result of all this is complacent users. It cuts against generativity when the interfaces disappear. It cuts against the play of everyday practice. It's hard to play with that which has become invisible to you. And from this perspective, the DMCA and the design of the iPad are two sides of the same coin. They both work to instill complacency and behavioral kind of dampening the amplitude of individual behavior in ways that I think we ought to at least stop and think about. I think we ought to do more than stop and think about it, because I think when you add all this up, the resulting combination of surveillance control and operational opacity is really troubling. So consider this quote. This is from Elaine Scarry, who wrote an article in the Boston Review in 2004 about the USA Patriot Act. And she said, "The Patriot Act inverts the constitutional requirement that people's lives be private and the work of government officials be public. It instead crafts a set of conditions in which our inner lives become transparent and the workings of the government become opaque. Either one of these outcomes would imperil democracy. Together, they not only injure the country, but also cut off the avenues of repair." Now, this observation is about government action, but I don't think it depends on the presence of government action for its truth. When we are exposed and the workings of our networked information environment are opaque, that outcome, too, works a profound injury to our society. The reconfiguration of our networked selves causes us to become different and causes us to have diminished ability to repair the injury or even to understand, I think, what is going on. Now, if I'm right about this, what should we do about it? You may think I'm not right about it, and of course we can talk about it in the Q&A, but just for the time being, assume I am right. What does this mean for the design of a wise and just program of information policy? So it means, first of all, that advocates of access to information or access to knowledge, or I could use the abbreviation A2K, are absolutely right. Access to knowledge is really good. When you have knowledge, you're in a position to do things. You're empowered to take action. But I think this also means that access to knowledge isn't the only important prong of a just information policy. And in some ways, it's the least of our problems. If protecting and fostering the play of everyday practice is important, we need to do more. We need to pay attention to the semantic structure of the networked information environment. And this suggests two additional foundational principles to other structural conditions of human flourishing, both of which are baked into the analog world to such a degree that we often don't even realize they're there. Operational transparency and semantic discontinuity. Two more mouthfuls. What do I mean by those? Operational transparency is meaningful transparency about how the networked world works. And the point here, I think, is pretty straightforward. The technical protocols that sort us, that shape our media environment, that authorize or deny us access to resources, are the basic operational laws of the networked information society. They're like Newton's laws in the physical world, and for human beings to flourish, we need meaningful access to those operational laws. We need access to the logics that determine how we're sorted and categorized and understood by the powerful state and commercial actors that shape our networked world, and to the logics that determine how the networked world presents itself to us. This suggests a range of reform efforts to be explored in areas ranging from openness in commercial search, openness in electronic voting, to openness in standard setting for media content platforms. It also suggests some fairly important reforms to information privacy regulation. Existing regimes sometimes attempt to guarantee us access to our own information. You could maybe know what information about you is stored in a database, but that, I think, tells you precisely nothing. What you want to know is how it's being used and what inferences are being drawn from it, and that's what they never tell you. Now, semantic discontinuity is, I think, a more counterintuitive concept. What I mean is to refer to gaps and to incompleteness within legal and technical architectures and within information systems. And the central insight here is that the play of everyday practice is inversely related to the completeness of legal and technical and information architectures. Gaps in those frameworks create the breathing room in which the play of everyday practice occurs. Now, it's counterintuitive because we tend to think, particularly when we've got our design hat on or our regulator's hat on, we tend to think that a good system is the most complete system. So a good technical system is one that ensures seamless portability of data and seamless interoperability between platforms and networks. A good system of regulation is one that provides for every eventuality and every exception. A good information system is one that has everything covered down to a very high level of granularity. And if we take the play of everyday practice as our lodestar, I think all of these intuitions are wrong. If we want to leave, for example, room for cultural mobility within the copyright regime, copyright rights should have fixed borders, they should stop, and there should be plenty of room on the other side, even if we have no idea what is going to be happening there. If we want to preserve breathing room for boundary management in the development of emergent subjectivity, this way that I want us to redefine privacy, we should erect fixed, definite, cumulative, and redundant barriers to information processing. Complete records should be difficult to assemble, information should degrade, it should be hard to keep complete records, things should become kind of Swiss cheesy. And if we want to leave room for technical diversity, we need to recognize that seamless scalability and portability and interoperability may not always be good things, that the play of everyday practice thrives more reliably when openness and closure, when seamlessness and disconnection are in balance. So systemic imperfection, I'm suggesting, is a feature, not a bug, sometimes, often, much more often than we think, and its preservation should be a key prong of a just information policy. Now, that's where I'm going to stop, right? And where I'm stopping is still a very abstract place. I can poke fun at Benkler because he's in England or somewhere, right? I didn't really want to write a book that long. One of my goals is not necessarily to solve all this myself, but to get enough people convinced that these are the important problems to be thinking about so that those of you with way more expertise than I in things like computer system design could start to figure it out. I do think, however, that naming the attributes of a just information policy is an essential first step to achieving it. And so I will stop there. Thank you very much, and I'm really looking forward to your questions.
Thanks, Julie. That's really interesting, and I look forward to reading the book. I was wondering to what extent you see digital identity policy and practices as sort of part of the problem or solution. In particular, say the differences between common law and civil law societies where, say, in Europe and parts of Asia, just as in the bricks and mortar world, there's more digital identity, at least in a normative sense in Europe, with certain rights attached to it. Whereas in England or the US or Australia and Canada, it's, as we don't have national IDs, for example, mm-hmm. we also have these problems in the digital world. Which isn't to say that's enough, but if you had something like that, perhaps you could exercise rights in a default way as you navigate these different architectures.
So, and when you say if you had something like that, is that an identity card, an identifier, or just protection for a digital identity?
Well, whether or not it would be the start of certain protections as I, in my network self, exercise certain things in the commercial or public world. So, example is, say, Estonia has a is a physical card, you know, with, however, it's really not the card per se, but how digital architecture might be built around that. And, or not to carry on too much, but with, say, personal digital stores where I might say, here's my information, here's what kind of information I will share with what kinds of entities, and I could change that over time. And getting to, I think, your last point about certain information not being kept for very long. Some of the ideas Victor Schoenberger brought up with delete and all that, that you might need such a structure, at least as part of the solution.
Right, so you might need the structure of an identifier to then have a system to then poke
and
holes
say,
in,
this is me,
or to set up protections for it.
I want to keep forever, and these are the photographs I don't want to keep for very long.
Right.
You are Facebook, or the government, or my bank, or my employer.
You might. You might. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? With our, Wild West American strand of libertarianism, we tend to think any identifier system is certainly not going to be freedom enhancing.
And of course, that's not American, that's Anglo. Australia and UK have the same problem.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't be in a position to rule it out. I do think it's important just to make sure, as I try to do throughout the book, that what you wouldn't want to do is kind of have a separation so that you've got rights to protection of some digital identity that just kind of exists in digital space where it has attributes. One of the key points I'm trying to make here is that's actually not how we experience ourselves, right? We exist in the physical world, and that's how we experience our artifacts through kind of the medium of our embodied perception. So it's protection for a digital identifier or a digital system of identity makes sense to the extent that it can be designed, I think, to reinforce some of the beneficial attributes of the offline world that we come to rely on in this process of identity play. And it's, I think, entirely plausible that, as you suggest, that could be a way to do that. Hi. I don't have to stand there anymore. I'm not.
Precise question, but I'm just curious why mm-hmm. you chose the word networked, and like in what sense, there's a Bruno Latour has talked about networks, and Castells has talked about the network society,
right?
Doing really different things. So, curious where you're coming from.
Yeah, and I. So you've kind of opened the methodology can of worms in a way with that question, right? And the selection of that term wasn't really intended to pose the methodology question. It just sort of seemed the obvious term to use. But I also want to recapture the idea of being networked from this kind of disembodied cyberspace that we've thrown it into and bring it back to be rooted in the real embodied person. Now, I take what somebody trained in one of the fields that you mentioned or some others might consider to be methodological liberties, right? Because the point, I think, is not to kind of delve deep into the kind of the knockdown, drag-out tribal wars between rival tribes of academics about whether it should be actor network theory or whether it should be something else, right? But to sort of to see if after sifting through all of that, there are these common themes, which I think there very much are, right? Whether you want to call it an actor network or a non-human or, whatever. So that's what I do, and I'm quite bold-faced about it. And that kind of leads into a second methodological problem, which is that legal academics are like day trippers, right? We find cool stuff somewhere and do book reports on it. And I didn't want to be doing that. I think that's not necessarily... It's important that in the book I say we're magpies, right? We find shiny stuff and we pick it up and we bring it back to our nest, and that's good. It leads to a lot of productive ferment, but you have to kind of do enough work to make sure you more or less understand the shiny thing that you picked up. But at the same time, information policy has this aspect of needing to draw from everywhere to make sense. So I think it is a defensible enterprise in this context as long as one is careful. So, yeah. Hi.
Hi. One of your readers complimented your use of the capabilities of nudge.
Mm-hmm.
And your discussion about the kind of self-election or self-selection that it represents. Do you think that represents a game? Configure implies a technical.
Do I think the capabilities approach represents a what?
A gate.
A gate. What do you mean?
In a technical sense.
A gate, and I don't understand the term as it's used in the question.
That there would be a technical impediment.
Okay. Okay. Yes, right? We're not going to make everybody into a programmer. That's the question, right? But the question is whether there's going to be enough access provided in enough different meaningful ways to A, provide the capability for those who do know, and B, bring others into the discussion, right? Enough translation of what is going on that we could have some kind of greater public discussion about, for example, electronic voting, even if we can't all go design an electronic voting algorithm. I certainly can't. Capabilities come in multiple forms, right? We just seem to be kind of systematically shutting them all down. with respect to certain kinds of architectures, and that I think is troubling.
Extent, do you think that what you're describing there is even a solvable problem? I mean, at a certain level, the world grows, and the artifacts in the world and the world in general grows ever more complicated every day. And, you know, once upon a time, all machines kind of were made out of the same basic stuff, and anybody who could fix a wagon could fix, you know, all the machines in the world. And now the complexity of these things is so overwhelming that that it's just not practical to imagine that everything should be operationally transparent. People don't have an understanding of the basics, which I think can lead to a certain amount of alienation in the world. Like, people just don't know what a computer is, they don't know how it works, and consequently they don't know how the basics about any of their devices. But even if they did know some of those things, they're just not gonna get everything. And this makes, among other things, you describe a voting machine, it's a good example. If one were to imagine that there should be available some description of how voting machines work, it would almost immediately become politicized, and then you'd have the problem of, like, well, whose description of the voting machine do I believe? And I just feel like there's just a certain weight of complexity that's problematic.
Right, and it is. It's really problematic, but think about what enables the discussion to be so politicized. It's the filter bubble idea, right? That you go online to find out about it, and what gets served to you varies radically depending on who you are. And it's all kind of done to maximize comfort, right? Your comfort as the consumer of information. And what we ought to be doing, arguably, is giving you a hefty serving of discomfort. Right, the Brussels sprouts along with the chocolate cake, and I actually like Brussels sprouts, and I don't mean to malign them, but there are benefits we get when our media environment, when our information environment is ideologically heterogeneous, and we've kind of given that up, right, without even knowing it. And you could think about, and people are doing really interesting work on that problem already, there are really concrete ways to start making interventions into that, and to serve people less ideologically divisive and distinct media universes, which could be the beginning of having a better conversation about it. Maybe. We're not going to make the complexity go away. But you know, if you start to kind of peel away the layers of the process of how we form the opinions, I love that you use the term alienation, and I'm about to get myself into big trouble here, but we could play on the word alienation, right? If we were inclined to be, you know, Marxist for 30 seconds, even though it's really unfashionable in the American Academy today, we're kind of being alienated from the production of our personalities, right? People, we're just having this media environment served to us, and we don't even know how it works. That we could work on, and that might be good enough. It would have to be, right? Because we're not all going to become algorithm designers. You're absolutely right about that.
I really appreciated the distinction you made when you were talking about operational transparency about how it's used. So I wonder, I'm hearing perhaps less of an, I'm less invested in a kind of liberal notion of the liberatory possibility of knowing the operations, and I think the conversation around the politics of algorithms is a real meaty place to think about. It may not be knowable, but what I can know is to what purpose is it being used, or what's the goal in producing that operation. So I'm just wondering if I'm making that distinction, is that a distinction you want to make? Do you think the operation itself is important here, or is it to what purpose? That, you know, if I'm thinking particularly about algorithms.
Right. I think there are ways and ways to get more transparency, right? Maybe knowing the algorithm isn't going to tell most people anything. What about, you know, an ability to run scenarios? Change a variable and see what that changes. That could be really interesting. You know, we are a society of communicators, right? And this is a problem in communication. So it would seem, again, that there could be lots of ways to come at this problem. And I'm not wedded to any one of those ways. And I think your point is a good one.
Just to zoom out a bit from mm-hmm. the American or Anglo whatever perspective that we've sort of been focusing on.
Right.
If you look to various developments in the EU about data privacy and so on, does that at all change the shape of the story that you tell if you sort of look at it from that perspective? Or
yeah, it's so interesting. It might. And so now I have to give the public service announcement, right? The Harvard Law Review is doing a privacy symposium this Friday in Langdale South. I have a paper in it, and a very interesting paper in the symposium is by Paul Schwartz from UC Berkeley on the European process of revising the data protection rules and what that signals for privacy regulation. So if you want to hear more about that, just show up 2 days from now. There are things in the proposed regulation that I'm really excited about, like the right to be forgotten, like an expanded right of access to the logics used to make decisions about people. This is what I'm talking about, right? And a question, I guess I have two, well, I have lots of questions. Okay, so here are some questions, right? Assuming that's what ends up being in the regulation, because right now it's only a proposed regulation, how does that get exported to other jurisdictions? Or do we put other things in there, for example, the provisions that are in there now for so-called binding corporate rules, so an entity like Google that operates in multiple jurisdictions can get an opinion from one data protection regulator in one place and operate everywhere. Do we put other things in there that encourage a race to the bottom, notwithstanding the formal language about the right to be forgotten or whatever? I think that's an open question. and the other really big can of worms is the big data or predictive analytics or whatever you want to call it. The more I read about big data, kind of the more freaked out I get, because it's not clear to me you can have transparency about how it works in the way that I'm implicitly presuming that you can. Which means that our thinking about transparency also needs to take some kind of quantum leap, and I'm not yet sure what it is. Right? The process entails, as I understand it, constantly sifting through volumes of heterogeneous data and constantly changing and refining the analytics, so it's not even clear what you could tell anybody about the basis for decisions that were made. And there's some interesting work being done by people kind of training scrutiny on academic computational science and saying, as to that, we can't even get good disclosure about how it works. So the European thing makes me optimistic in a qualified way, and then the big data thing makes me really nervous. And I don't know how that cashes out to, we'll see. Are you all really depressed now?
Do we have maybe one or two last questions? Last comments as well.
This is something we've been batting around mm-hmm. a little bit, which is just getting at, I guess, this question of big data has been nagging at lots of people, of course, but thinking about ways of the sort of operational transparency or mm-hmm. that people make when they're sifting through big data, and mm-hmm. that might be part that, and then the algorithms around how the data gets collected are, I think, all sort of wrapped into that operational transparency thing. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
It makes sense to me. I'm intending this as a provocation and an invitation, right? If you think the description sounds right, please start helping to figure this out. right? How can we get the transparency in a way that would be meaningful for the different constituencies to which the efforts at transparency needs to be directed? How can we get the semantic discontinuity in systems? We've been accustomed to thinking that that's kind of an accidental property of the physical world, and we go around trying to squash it out. How can we think in an opposite way about that, please? If you think it's a good description, start to think about the problem of how to operationalize the response. And that's that.
Any last comments or questions? Hopefully Julie will stick around for a couple minutes afterwards.
I will, and thank you so much for coming out in the snow.
And thank you so much for presenting. So please stick around, have some snacks, and thank you again to Julie.
Thank you.
And the book is for sale and also online. So.